It is Sunday, November 3rd for Patreon subscribers and Monday, November 4th for the rest of yous. Welcome to the, I guess, the second Million Listen Show. I'm just going to, we should rename it to the Million Listen Show. really fired up and honestly humbled and appreciative of just, I guess, the support, the momentum that this show has received. And it's further evident as we launch this tailgate because we sold almost half the tickets already. And we're, what, about 3 weeks out from the Penn State game on November 23rd. So make sure you get those tickets. People have been hitting me up about details. Here's what I can tell you. It's going to be it's a covered lot. It's going to be heated. We have TVs in there. We're going to have audio-video setup. We're going to have a bunch of good food, not hamburgers and hot dogs. All food is going to be included.
What's wrong with hamburgers and hot dogs?
It's not like a crappy tailgate get cheap hamburgers and hot dogs. You're going to have good food. There's going to be alcohol there. There's going to be drinks there. That will be included. We're working some alcohol vendor deals to try to make it just all-inclusive. Worst case scenario, it'll be like a three-drink ticket, maybe four-drink ticket type of thing. But that's worst case. So we have 3 weeks to iron that out. Hopefully in the next week I'll give more details into it. But you're going to want to be there. It's going to be awesome. I've had some unbelievable ideas sent to us from listeners of what we should do at the tailgate. So it's going to be really cool. I don't want to spend the whole show talking about it, but check out our website, menace2societypodcast.com. Go to our shop, get the tickets. It's also on all of our social media. So make sure you secure those because there is a cap. Like, we will sell out. I think right now 300 is the max we can do. So we've already sold almost half, but almost half of those. So make sure you jump in there and get those tickets because they will sell out. So check it out. But huge, a lot of stuff happening. Willie Taggart, number one.
Yeah.
But let's get to the show. Let's get to the content. Here we go.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on Earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my
All right, welcome to Menace to Society, the college football show, under the hood, inside access, just getting into the mind of someone that used to be in the industry, I guess, 15 years in the coaching industry, trying to give a different perspective and spin on analysis, I guess, and just college football in general, because I can't stand sports media. And it's one of those, like, caveats, like, I guess, technically, this kind of is sports media.
Definitely, yeah.
But I refuse to relate to those peoples.
You are one now.
Yeah, but you can't stand yourself.
I guess not. I'm a self-hated guy, I guess. But huge news. Willie Taggart fired at Florida State University. Spent 5 years in the state and involved at the University of Florida, so know Florida State very well. Also, we have detailed several times the error in hiring Willie Taggart. Going back to the summer, we outlined how that was a shocking hire, a ridiculous hire, especially for Florida State. And now here we are. The second head coach's casualty of the 2019 season is Willie Taggart. Chris Ash at Rutgers, now Willie Taggart at Florida State.
I don't think it's surprising. Not to me.
There's
so many things, and here's what I wanted to talk about in relation to that. First of all, you go 9-12 at Florida State now.
Yeah.
Not 9-12 at Western Kentucky. Not 9-12 at South Florida. You're at Florida State, 9-12, and people want to talk about Jimbo Fisher left the cupboard bare. No, he didn't. No. They had some very highly ranked classes. It was simply about player development, coaching, all of the above. I mean, it was about coaching. It wasn't about recruiting. To win early, you have to develop players, change the culture, and make it a winning culture. That's what you have to do. And the real question here is, why did anyone expect better?
Right.
And I don't want to reevaluate that hire because we already had an entire show almost about it.
Yeah.
But it's like, what did you think was going to happen? Right. I don't know why people were shocked. Like, the whole time it's going on, I'm like, yep.
Yeah,
that's what you hired. but ultimately, when you see something like this, this guy was 9-12 at FSU, 21 games. This was not a he didn't get the job done thing. This was not a he didn't get the job done firing. You can't fire a guy after 21 games because he quote unquote did not deliver. This was a firing because in their mind, what they just made the statement after firing a guy after a year and a half was, we made an epic mistake in hiring this guy. That's what it was. It was not like, oh man, he didn't get it done. No, it was, oh shit, we screwed it up.
This might ruin our school.
He's never going to get it done.
Yeah.
And we really made a mistake. And I will say this is not going to be like every other sports media show where they just say, oh, he deserved it. He did this. This is why he got fired. No. This hits close to home for a number of reasons. One, I obviously got fired a year and a half ago, and it sucks. It really sucks. Some could say rightfully so. Some could say I shouldn't have. It doesn't really matter. It sucks no matter what, whether you deserved it or didn't. And I promise you this much, whether you think Willie Taggart deserved to get fired or not, there's people there that did a good job. It doesn't matter who. I'm not going to dive into who I think did a good job and who didn't. But there are coaches, recruiting guys, I don't know, whatever, operations guy. There's people in the program that did a good job that are now fired.
Yeah, that's a lot of people that just lost their job. It's not just Willie Taggart.
It's a lot of people, a lot of wives, a lot of kids. Exactly. Like a lot of people lost their job. And the only thing I can relate it to, obviously I can relate it to myself getting fired, but I think that's a very different situation for obvious reasons. But what I can relate it to is back in 2009, when I was at Florida, Urban resigned, and he ended up not resigning. It was
I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah, it was that Brett Favre, I retire, and then before the season, I don't retire anymore.
Still gonna play.
But nonetheless, when he resigned, and he called us all in a staff room and told us he was resigning, he basically read a statement to his staff, to the people that he's in the war room with. Read a statement and walked out, and there was no discussion, no conversation. It was just, I've decided for me, my health, and my family that I will be resigning as the head coach at Florida. I wish you all the best, and walked out. And I'll never forget the feeling in the building, because I'm 2009. I was a 24-year-old, about to be a full-time coach, and I was sitting there in the back of the room, not even at the staff table, and you could cut the, I guess, animosity, the anxiety, the stress. You could cut it with a knife in the air. The coaches, everyone, it was this overwhelming feeling of holy shit, I don't have a job anymore.
Yeah, it's what now?
And I mean, that was very different because that staff and that program was one of the best. Mm-hmm. And it was so disheartening and so, I was witnessing it man, I hope this never happens to me. This is awful.
Yeah.
I mean, these coaches are 30-year coach vets. They've been in coaching for however long. And it's the feeling was unbelievable because you could feel it. It's man, I have a mortgage. I have a whole family relying on me.
Exactly.
We won games. And this was at Florida. And there, don't get me wrong, there's people at Florida State that did an excellent job that are probably great coaches or great recruiting directors that did a great job. And they have to go home and tell their family, we have to find a job, that could mean things might be really hard moving forward. Mm-hmm. And never mind in staff transition. Then you're trying to maybe get the new coach to make you one of the two coaches that gets retained. Yep. I mean, there's so many things.
Well, they could move their entire family. You have to move now, or different things.
I mean, it is a major life event, and it can be. I mean, you think about, imagine. Some of the coaches I worked with, they got a 9-year-old, and that kid has friends.
Exactly.
And
you have to move now.
But people watch football and they see players, scores, and a coach, and they think, fire that asshole. And it's bro, that I'm not saying he didn't deserve it, and I get it. That's what you sign up for. But ex coach over here has a 9-year-old who has three best friends, finally fit in after moving here a year and a half ago.
Right.
And you have to go tell that 9-year-old that. As much as he cried and as much as he hated it and didn't want to move to Tallahassee, Florida, probably going to have to do it again.
Yeah, we're moving to Virginia.
And that is, I mean, a major life event and a major negative aspect of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I think this ultimately, I don't know how it can't happen, but they should sue Florida State. Everyone on staff should sue Florida State and be like, I'm sorry, you made a mistake in who you hired. That's not our fault.
Yeah.
We delivered what you wanted. You signed us up. we are here.
I guess the coaches kind of sign up for that also. They know what they're getting into.
Right.
And like I said, they get paid very handsomely for doing
that.
It doesn't make it sucks. Yeah.
It doesn't make it less hard.
And I mean, it doesn't fix all the problems, but most coaches that go through something like that get some sort of severance package for their contract or whatever kind of, you know, payment to get out of it.
Yeah, head coaches. I'm not talking about head coaches. Head coaches get that. Well, what assistants don't get severance?
Absolutely not.
Most, I mean, unless they're on a 2-year contract, then maybe they get a nickel. Hmm. But coaches don't know. Unless you're on a multi-year contract, then you might. But if you're on a 1-year contract, nope. After the season, you're gone. No severance, no nothing. Go find a job. Yeah. There's nothing like that. But I do want to say, I do want to address this and look at this from the perspective of someone that's been inside that industry, has been in the state of Florida. I spent 5 years of my career in the state of Florida in big-time college football. I saw Florida State go through the end of the Bobby Bowden era. I saw Miami go through the end of the Larry Coker era. And I saw those programs coming off their highs and kind of going down. And here's what I really believe Florida State needs to do to get back to relevancy in the state. Because I mentioned it before, when Willie Taggart got hired, I was recruiting South Florida. That made me nervous. I mean, here's a young quote-unquote recruiter coming into Florida State. And Florida State's a monster. It's a sleeping giant. I mean, you think about the successes they had. And there's an affinity for Florida State, especially in South Florida where I recruited. Kids just really like it. And I could tell you all the reasons why. One, Tallahassee's great. The program has a lot of these kids were fans of Florida State growing up, especially now with the Jameis Winston National Championship. Like, they loved Florida State as when they were 13 or whatever, which is huge. And also, you go to Tallahassee, and it's a great time. One, it's the easiest school to get into out of the big three. Yeah. Yep. Two, there's what FAMU right there, which is an all-black college, HBCU. Mm-hmm. And so there is an enormous amount of co-eds. So it is a very attractive place to go to college. So when he first got hired there, I was like, oh, man, it might be a little harder to recruit South Florida. And it wasn't. It wasn't at all.
What do they say in Gainesville, though? North till you smell it and west till you step in it.
Yeah, probably. Sounds about right. But here's what I believe Florida State needs to do to get back to the relevancy in the state. And if they do that, if they want to do that, they won't do what I'm about to tell you they should do. Not a chance. There's no chance this happens. But if they want to actually get back into relevancy, they should go hire Doc Holliday from Marshall.
Ooh.
Here's why. He is probably the most legendary recruiter in South Florida ever.
Yeah.
Ever. If they want to win at Florida State, they're going to have to recruit South Florida and Tampa extremely well. Mm-hmm. If you want to do that, you hire Doc Holliday. You bring in Jaywon Sider from Penn State, who is Doc's protege per se. He recruited in West Virginia. He's now at Penn State. He has been phenomenal recruiting South Florida. Then you lock down South Florida. Doc and Jaywon, they could do that. You bring in a guy like Sean Cronin, who's at South Florida right now, who's had a long history at a lower level than Florida State, but recruiting Polk County, Orlando, even West Palm Beach. And then you keep a guy like Odell Higgins on. They could build a superstar staff, but not just recruiting staff. I'm talking about guys that really have had a long-standing history recruiting well, but can coach, can develop. And I mean, the three guys I just mentioned, they have a resume that can rival anyone. Okay. And I could think of 10 other names that they could hire as assistants that could just absolutely make a huge impact in state. And I think that's what they need to do.
My thought for the head coaching job is somebody who's at South Florida now that's also a legendary recruiter of South Florida.
Yeah, that's never going to happen. I mean,
no.
I mean, look at his success at South Florida. I mean, he's fighting for his job at South Florida. That's not a sexy hire. I mean, that would have been a sexy hire if he was still the defensive coordinator at Florida or the head coach at Louisville. But what he's done at Texas and what he's done at South Florida, I'm with you. That would be a great hire. There's no way they do that.
Yeah.
Not with what's happened at Texas and South Florida so far.
Yeah, that's
but,
true.
But, I mean, if you just wanted to make a great hire, that would be a great hire, but they won't do that.
I love that idea of Doc Holliday at Florida State.
Well, here's the other guy, and this won't happen either, but the other one that they absolutely should make a run at is go get the coach that actually is winning at Oregon. A guy that is relentless and can recruit South Florida. He's one of the best recruiters in South Florida in the last 10, 15 years. And he was very successful at FIU. He got a raw deal. I've talked about him a number of times. Mm-hmm. He was at Alabama. Now he's at Oregon. They're a one-loss team. And in my opinion, should be undefeated. They should have beat Auburn, but we all know how that went.
Yeah.
You go hire Mario Cristobal, and now you're getting, I guess, a much improved Willie Taggart, like a much better Willie Taggart.
You're getting your guy from Oregon. It's just this time it's a better guy from Oregon.
Right, and here's what here's my biggest fear for Florida State fans and Florida State in general is that they go hire a great coach that's a bad fit, mm-hmm. a Luke Fickell, Matt Campbell at Iowa State. That's
just for like a hot name.
Well, not because they're great coaches, and they might figure it out, but if you're only giving a guy a year and a half, those guys aren't Florida guys.
Yeah.
They don't know that.
Well, I mean, Fickell's a Midwest guy, and so Campbell's Matt Campbell. A Midwest guy, and
And they'll talk about him. And the other one they talk about is Mark Stoops, and I mean, he's a really good coach. What he's done at Kentucky's phenomenal, and that I don't think that would be a misfit, but I think there's a bigger name out there that they could get that could make a greater impact. You got to think this is the most heavily recruited state in the country. Florida, Georgia, Texas, California, most heavily recruited states in the country. You need somebody that, I mean, has a proven, I'm talking 25-year track record of being able to recruit Florida against everyone. Like, who has beat Alabama? Who has beat these teams and gotten kids and knows the coaches and knows the landscape? But I don't want to talk about it forever, but I could. They are at a crossroads of all crossroads right now, because they have slowly declined. The whole Jimbo thing blew up, and now here we are with Willie Taggart. Horrible hire, in my opinion. And now it implodes like anyone with a brain would have saw coming. And now it's like, oh shit, this is that hire that either brings us, kind of creeps us back into relevancy, or completely ruins all the momentum that Bobby Bowden built for 30-some years.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just the reality of it.
Yep.
But that also brought me up to another point I wanted to talk about is there was, I guess, because now Willie Taggart got fired, four coaches in their second year, and all of them are 4-5 right now. And so I think Clay Travis put it out, like, whose program is the strongest right now? Those four coaches, second-year head coaches, all 4-5 right now. Chip Kelly at UCLA, Scott Frost at Nebraska, Jeremy Pruitt at Tennessee, and then Willie Taggart obviously just got let go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So those are four coaches with, honestly, similar production. And that's why it's like, oh, Willie Taggart got fired. Clearly, they thought that was a mistake from the beginning.
Yeah.
Where those other three coaches, I think that the programs think, you know what, it's not going as planned. It's not going as we hoped, but there's hope moving forward. And so the question is, which program is got the best chance for a strong outlook in the future?
Yeah, I think you look at that list, and the first two you mentioned, Chip Kelly and Scott Frost, obviously have the support of the program.
Yeah, I think they have the longest leash.
Yeah, the longest leash. You have Scott Frost is supposed to be the savior of Nebraska, and he's struggling in his second year, and you even thought, and everybody thought, this would be a year that they improved greatly. They haven't. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Pruitt has – I've been impressed with Tennessee since everything happened in the beginning of the year, how they've rebounded from it.
Exactly.
Because I thought Jeremy Pruitt would go the way of Willie Taggart right now.
Me too, yeah.
But they've rebounded from that embarrassing Georgia Southern or Georgia State, whichever one it was.
Who cares?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Whichever loss. But Chip Kelly and Scott Frost, I think, are the two that have the longest leash and have the programs in the better spots.
Yeah, and ultimately, I think what's going to hurt Chip Kelly is the Pac-12's garbage. And he's 4-5 in a garbage conference.
Yeah.
Scott Frost and Jeremy Pruitt are coaching in strong conferences. So I'm not saying they're not doing a good job at UCLA. I'm not saying that won't work out in the end. Mm-hmm. But he is producing the same as Scott Frost or Jeremy Pruitt in a much lesser conference.
Much easier
conference. UCLA has had some flashes of good play.
They have. We mentioned it last episode. There's a chance they can still win
the whole damn thing.
Two of those three that are at their schools still have a chance.
Yeah, which, I mean, probably not anymore.
No, yeah, probably not anymore, but they did the weekend.
I do want to talk about one other thing, kind of to segue that. I watched Fox Big Noon Kickoff. It's hard to say that. They need to rename it.
Yeah, that needs to be just Fox Noon Kickoff.
Right, but either way, I listened to the breakdown of Justin Herbert, and I listened to Urban praising Justin Herbert on the pregame show right before the Oregon game, not on the 11 o'clock show, but right before the Oregon game. They cut to studio, and they were praising Justin Herbert. And it really struck me, because I watched all last year Justin Herbert. Over the summer, I've watched all but, I think, one or two games this year, and I was blown away at how much he was selling this kid. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there like, why does he think that? Like, has he watched the film? And this is my issue with sports media, because I know how smart Urban is. And I know, I mean, if he cut on the film of seven games, I mean, he's going to have as spot on an analysis on a player as anyone, better than I would. And so I'm sitting here like, why would he say that? So then I tweeted about it because I disagreed with his assessment. His assessment was that he was this great leader, great player, you know, one of the top three quarterbacks in the country. I mean, just on and on and on, the accolades, the projections, the analysis. And I was sitting here like, I don't think he's in the top five. I don't think he's a first-round draft pick. I mean, I disagree entirely. I've watched six games this year, and then he went out in the first quarter. And when I tweeted about it, it was after the first quarter. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I will be as an open book as anyone. He turned it on after I tweeted about it, which
he saw your tweet.
But I mean, he turned it on and played extremely well for the final three quarters against a very below average USC team.
Yeah.
But the first quarter, he was 3 of 7 for 27 yards, had one horrific throw for an interception. Oregon had 16 yards on offense total. He started off horrible. And I've seen that out of him all year, because he's so inconsistent. And what they did was they did a great job putting him in position for success after that. Mm-hmm. I mean, six of his completions, he was 6 for 6 behind the line of scrimmage on little screens, little touches, quick touches. He was another 8 for 9 from 0 to 10 yards. So under 10 yards, he was whatever that is, 14 of 15. Which is great. You set him up for success. This is supposed to be the number one quarterback coming out, right? They said last year he was the number one quarterback possibly coming out. He was 0 for 3 throwing the ball over 20 yards. And I mean, I think he played about above average. That's what he played. And he started off horrible. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I do want to say he played really well. He graded out over 90%. He finished really strong. This has not been his MO all year. He has been inconsistent throughout the year. I mean, he played very poorly against Auburn, below average against Cal, and then he started this game below average. He has been inconsistent, and the way he started the game Saturday was no different. He comes out slow, looks very average, and then he turned it on and plays the way a top QB talent should against the 94th ranked defense in America. They're the 79th best pass defense in America. There should have been no slow start. This should have been a top 10 pick, dicing up a depleted and poor secondary and defense, but it wasn't. And so it really made me think, like, how much film do these guys watch? And I know a couple from my time as a coach, and I know a couple that do watch a lot of film. Like I've said before, Joey Galloway, I know, watches a lot of film. I think Brady Quinn watches a lot of film, because him and I had conversations over my career several times where I was like, yeah, he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's really watched us or watched whoever. I do know this. It's probably similar. Urban is probably similar to how he game planned as a head coach. And here's how he game planned. He would watch 3 hours of film on Monday morning, and that was it. Done. He felt like, all right, I saw what I need to see. Then he relied on stats and things on the board. And if he found out one of the stats was wrong, he would blow up because it was he's basing all of his opinions on that list on the board.
Yeah.
And it made me think, like, I'm sure that's how he's commentating or analyzing or whatever it is he watches enough, and then he gets stats and analytics from an intern, really studies them, and then he feels like he has an opinion. And it's like, I wish he would watch the film, and he probably doesn't want to spend the time doing it. Yeah, I don't blame him. Sure. Yeah. He doesn't have to. But it just made me think, like, how can – this is what, in my opinion, is the best analytics show on sports media. Yeah. How can they be wrong twice like that? Like, talking about Oklahoma's defense was finally elite. Alex Grinch brought him back to elite status. And I'm sitting here like, what? Nope. Where? I mean, they're much improved, but – elite. Whoa, timeout. He's the first one that gets pissed when you use the word when it's not applicable.
Yeah. And it's a buzzword for sure.
And then to talk about Justin Herbert, like, he's one of the top three quarterbacks in the country. So like, he's not. He's just not. But that being said, I think Oregon and Utah are the two teams in the Pac-12 that are obviously destined to meet up.
Yeah, they'll meet in the middle
and,
for sure.
And they are the ones that if they handle their business, could be making an argument for the playoffs. The SEC is clearly now a Georgia in the East, Alabama, the winner of Alabama LSU this weekend.
Yep.
That's the destined matchup outside of some bizarre scenario where Auburn beats Alabama and then all of a sudden it's like a complete train wreck. The Big Ten is very clearly right now Ohio State, Penn State versus Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
probably Iowa has an outside chance, right?
Yeah, Minnesota's got some tough games down the road.
They do. But I'm saying right now, as it stands, Ohio State, Penn State, the winner of that game
probably comes out of the East.
Probably comes out of the East and probably comes out of the Big Ten.
Yeah.
The Big 12 is really bizarre. Ooh,
yeah.
I mean, right now it's Baylor.
Yeah, well, do they have divisions like that, or how do they do it? They're just the top two teams play.
Yeah, it's weird. It's bizarre. Yeah. It's very bizarre. But right now it looks like Baylor is going to be one.
Baylor and Oklahoma, probably.
But, I mean, and you know, Baylor has some tough games. They still have to play Oklahoma and Texas. But Baylor's the team to beat right now. And then there's the little old ACC.
Just skip over this one. Let's go.
Little old ACC. There's Clemson. And that's about it.
Clemson and whoever. I don't know.
Did we iron out who could win the Coastal yet, or is there still a possible 7-way tie at 4-4?
I certainly don't care. So, no.
Does it really matter? No.
It's like, which mouse do you pick to feed to the boa constrictor? I don't know. It doesn't really matter. Just feed them to Clemson, and let's see how good Clemson is in the playoff. That's about the extent of it. But I still, I talked about it. Earlier, or I guess end of last week, how Clemson, I think, has improved. They've done things that I said they needed to do, and they were doing it. Trevor Lawrence is developing. That offense is developing. So I think Clemson is a much more formidable contender on the national landscape than they were 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they're going to be tested at all.
The nice thing is that they get these easy games each week to go do it and get better. Like they have Wofford this week. Absolutely. Like, okay, that's just a practice.
Wofford, unbelievable. Yeah.
But that's a little national landscape, a little current event conversation. But I really want to talk about the game of the week. Florida-Georgia, the world's largest outdoor cocktail party did not disappoint. And I do want to review my preview because after the game, I was like, man, I kind of called all that.
You're just going to toot your own horn.
I am going to toot my own horn. Because
15 minutes, here you go.
He's willing to still call it the world's largest outdoor cocktail party, but he won't call it the Red River Shootout.
Yeah, right. Yep, unbelievable.
Political correctness, man.
Well, I don't like shooting. So,
but he loves cocktail parties.
Yeah. I'll drink a cocktail. I won't shoot anybody. That is what it is.
Anyways, let's get back to the
game. But here was my analysis of the game. I said Florida would struggle on third down. They certainly did. 22% on third down. That is a major problem. I said Florida wouldn't be able to run the ball. They did not. 21 yards. You can't do that if you're a top 10 team. And don't get me started on the fact that they are still a top 10 team.
Yeah.
But you cannot run the ball for 21 yards, 1.1 yards per carry, and win the football game. I also detailed the inequality of Florida's O-line against Georgia's front seven. It was absolutely apparent the whole game. They dominated the run game, two sacks. They forced 20 total QB pressures on 40 attempted pass plays. Half of the times Kyle Trask was dropping back to pass, he felt some type of pressure. Mm-hmm. It was a complete destruction. And what I didn't talk about and should have was Dan Mullen showed his ass, almost Tom Herman fashion, on how he mismanaged issues the entire game. And I mean, like, issues are going to happen. I don't care if you're the best team to ever play college football. You're going to have some issues in a game. You're going to have adversity. It's about how you manage it. And the players respond to how the coaches manage it. And we talked about it a little bit, like with Notre Dame getting their ass whooped last week. And I talked about what it's like to be in that scenario. Mm-hmm. And this is a much smaller microcosm of that. But it was infectious. I watched it on the sideline. I mean, he ripped the running back coach a handful of times, wasted a timeout once. I mean, the timeout, I get it, why you'd be pissed. Yeah. They're coming off the sideline, and there was no running back in the game, and he went ballistic. And it actually happened one other time. I'm not going to say who it was, but at Florida, it happened once, and where we came off the sideline, and there was no running back in the game, and Dan was in the box throwing shit. Like, he was like, you coach one fucking guy.
Yeah, I know.
Like, you can't make sure your one guy is in the
game.
You're
responsible for three people total.
Right. I mean, he went off. And then I saw him absolutely destroying Billy Gonzalez, their receiver coach, because a play was about to happen, and like a couple of wide receivers didn't know the play, and they're like looking, didn't know it, and they had to call another timeout. So there was a number of things, which happens. Those things sometimes happen. I mean, you obviously would like them not to happen, but Dan Mullen mismanaged it so poorly, and the demeanor of the team is going to be infected by that. And he was a petulant little baby on the sideline when those things happen.
Well, he also did literally pull down his pants and show his ass.
Well, I think
I missed that. I thought that would have made SportsCenter, but
yeah, not many cameras got it. But I think what you saw was he was desperate. He knew he needed that game so badly, not for his job, but just to to get validity on his program.
Yeah, and take the next step.
Yeah, you know? Take the next step is what he had.
He was so tightly wound the entire game and so over the top. You just knew that that was what's going to happen.
Yeah. And so here's my initial reaction. My initial reaction from the game was I had a couple initial reactions. The first one is DeAndre Swift is one of the best backs in the country. Not only, mm-hmm. I mean, they did a good job limiting him running the football, but his pass protection was clinic. It reminded me of Ezekiel Elliott in that facet of his game. I mean, I'm talking about picking up linebackers, cutting linebackers, picking up protections. He was unbelievable. I mean, four times I was like, wow,
yeah.
Look at that. I mean, that's a play that no one cares about. And Zeke had, dozens of them in his time at Ohio State, times where he would be the lead blocker and cut a guy and just like do things. You're like, that is a great football player, not just a great runner, yeah. But he was, in my opinion, the player of the game because of that. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, maybe not the second, this might have been the first thing I noticed was holy horrific offensive line play by Florida. I mean, their left tackle graded out like 62%. The rest of the O-line was below 60%, and it was brutal.
We've mentioned that before, though.
Well,
that O-line was problems.
But that was that was one of the previews of the game for sure. But they showed up.
Yeah, right.
And also, there was a critical break for Florida that really helped them in the momentum of the game to try to stay in it when DeAndre Swift had that huge run and a holding call or whatever it was, the penalty. That was huge with four minutes left, I think. Mm-hmm. And the other one, the other huge play that just, I mean, was the difference in the game was when Lawrence Cager was wide open on a wheel route. And you watch, I rewatched it, and it's like, it's just zone coverage, thirds, one high coverage. And the safety that dropped down, the flat defender took the flat. The safety that dropped down has to carry the wheel. Yep. And the minute Cager starts to wheel, the safety starts looking around like he's confused, like running the other way. And I'm like, where are you going? Whoa, timeout. Whoa.
Just stay with him.
And he just let him, he just cut him loose.
Yeah. And I thought Cager played pretty well. Well, it was nice to have him back.
He definitely did. He was, and I'm going to talk about their offense in a minute, but mm-hmm. he was the one of the other players of the game for sure. But then when Florida's on defense, I was actually surprised that they didn't play better on defense. I mean, first of all, I've said it every show, and I might say it every show. I might just start off with like, hey, by the way, double-digit missed tackles, missed you lose tackles. The game. Florida missed 10 tackles, and you can't win the game, double-digit missed tackles. And the other thing they didn't do was they didn't pressure Jake Fromm. You can't let him sit back there.
Yep.
I mean, they had 9 total pressures to Georgia's 20. Mm-hmm. Georgia pressured Kyle Trask 20 times. Fromm got pressured 9 times. He had 20 on 29 true passing attempts. There was 20 receptions and 1 PBU. So the secondary did not show up. Mm-hmm. I mean, 20 of 29 is in 1 PBU. You had no more PBUs than that?
No, that's terrible.
CJ Henderson was targeted twice for 2 catches. And I didn't think he played horrible when I rewatched it this morning, but he did not play on the level of some of these other corners we're talking about in the country, like Diggs at Alabama or Jeff Okuda at Ohio State. He did not. Now, the other thing I will say is Jonathan Greenard is really good. The linebacker at Florida he is a really good player. Yeah, he had 3 of the 9 QB pressures himself and was their highest graded defensive player. He played phenomenal all game. But I've said it since August, and I think it is still an accurate depiction of the Georgia offense. I think Jake Fromm is a really good quarterback. Not elite, really good. Mm-hmm. And I think they have 2 skill players on offense that are of a national caliber. DeAndre Swift went for 122 all-purpose yards, and Lawrence Cager had 132 receiving yards. Together, they had 64% of Georgia's entire production. And I think Lawrence Cager being out hurt them prior to this game. And I think him coming back was huge. But I don't think they have another player that is a nationally relevant skill player on offense. And that's their issue right now. Mm-hmm. And when Georgia went on defense, it's a whole other story. 6 missed tackles, single digit, then you win.
There you go. You get a win.
Simple
automatic.
As that.
Automatic.
And you know what they really did? Here's what I was most impressed with. Georgia felt that they could match up across the board and just needed to execute. That was their game plan.
Yep.
We don't need to do anything special. We just need to line up, know our assignment, and execute. They blitzed 7 snaps on 37 pass attempts. 7. They didn't even feel like they had to put pressure on Kyle Trask with blitzes.
That's disrespectful.
I mean, it was
yeah.
I mean, it was disrespectful, but it was an accurate depiction of Florida's O-line.
It's perfect. Yeah,
like we're good. We'll play base defense and just get pressure with twists and just straight execution.
Yeah,
and I mean, Florida on offense was exactly what I think they've always been. I will say that Michael Pirijn had made more positive yardage runs out of horrifically blocked plays than I've seen in a long time.
He
would have two guys that cut loose or beat a guy in the backfield, make a guy miss, break a tackle, and get three yards. And you're like, that was an impressive run. It won't say it on the stat sheet, but that was impressive.
And I'm telling you, give that guy an O-line. I wonder what he could be.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's for sure. And the other player on Florida's offense that there are two other players that I think are really good. One is Freddie Swain. He's the only offensive player that graded out over 80%. And I think he played really well. He had a bunch of yards, and I think he played well. The guy that is one of the nation's best tight ends is Kyle Pitts. And it's partly because they don't have much of skill on the perimeter, and the other part is he's that good.
Well, he's like a wide receiver.
I mean, he is. He was horrific in pass pro in the game, and that was part of their problem. But he was really, really good in the pass game.
Pass game, for sure.
Yeah. Here's what I'm mostly confused about, and I'll go on a rant for a minute, and then I'll stop. But I'm so confused why Van Jefferson isn't a feature in this offense. I watched him in high school. I watched him at Ole Miss. Even in the game against Georgia, he flashes. He makes a play, scores a touchdown. You're like, why are we not throwing this kid the ball more? and it's probably a number of reasons: O-line, quarterback, everything. But Van Jefferson is one of the most underutilized NFL talents in the country right now, and it's sad for him. But you know what? He made that decision. He could have came to Ohio State. I recruited him. He could be at Ohio State right now. That's just a fact. And he went to Florida because he was sold a pipe dream, and here we are, Van.
Yeah.
He made a mistake twice.
Can he go in the portal?
You know, he already went in the portal.
He
already did. I mean, I'm saying again.
No, this is it.
No, go be an undrafted free agent and see if you make it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think
he might be a mid-round drafted.
Guy. But I think it just kind of in conclusion, before we wrap up this, analysis section here is ultimately this is the plan to win, and it's infallible. It never fails. Georgia ran the ball decent. I won't say well, but they ran the ball decent. I mean, 3.2 yards a carry, 120 yards. Florida did not, 20 yards overall. That's a recipe for disaster. Florida was 2 of 9 on third down. Georgia was 12 of 18, 67%. That's a great day of third down production by Georgia. 4 of 4 in the red zone. We talk about critical offense. Those are the two critical scenarios where you need to make a play. Third down, red zone. They did it. And then single-digit missed tackles and no turnovers protected the football. You're going to win when you do that.
Yeah.
Well, that's literally the formula that everybody says when they talk about a game is run the ball, protect the ball, convert on fourth down and third down or red zone.
That's it. Yeah. And what I did feel on Saturday, which was awesome, is we are witnessing the revitalization of the cocktail party. I mean, it's back.
Yeah.
Back from the 05 to 2009 era. It is back. The rivalry is back, and here's the problem for Florida fans. Dan Mullen is Mark Richt, and Kirby Smart is Urban Meyer. They flipped roles. The rivalry is back.
What's wrong with being Mark Richt?
If you're going to lose,
you'll win 10 games a year and get fired after 15 years or whatever.
You're going to lose. If you're going to go 1-5 or whatever against Kirby Smart, that's a bad deal for Florida fans.
Yeah.
I mean, because ultimately the SEC East is a 2-team race right now and will be next year. Probably was last year.
Has been for a long time.
It's Florida, Georgia. And so if you can't win that game, you're probably not winning your division.
Yeah, 100%.
And so it's all going to come down to that game. And right now, Dan Mullen can't beat Kirby Smart. And the question is, will he be able to? And that's the ultimate question because it's back. It's back. They're two well-coached, good teams. The problem is they switched sides.
Yeah.
But it really, I guess, as we wrap up, the national implications of that game, it's outrageous to watch ESPN. Some of these ESPN employees, like Kirk Herbstreit and Heather Dinich, who I need to stop because she's just a cog, I know it. But they're putting Florida in the top 10 over like Oregon or Utah, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Watch the film. What are we doing?
Seriously.
Let's not herald Georgia to be Alabama. Georgia barely beat Notre Dame, lost to South Carolina. They're not an absolute top 5 team. Florida needs to be 15th in the country, and you need to let some of these teams in. Oregon, what are we talking about? They lost the first game of the year.
First game, and they should have won it.
And they probably should have won it. But anyways, we could talk about that forever.
I know.
It was really good to watch at least one good game this weekend. Really excited about this weekend coming up. Obviously, LSU-Bama is the game of the season.
Well, yeah, it's one against two.
Yeah, one against two, and it's going to be the matchup. And we're really excited to to analyze that in the next Menace to Society show coming up later this week. Really fired up about it. There's also some other...
That one's at Bryant-Denny, I believe.
It's at Bama, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
There's also Penn State plays Minnesota, two unbeatens. Ooh, I know the Midwest, Iowa, Wisconsin's a pretty good game. Mm-hmm. It could change the, I guess, trajectory of the Big Ten. So yeah, a lot of good games coming up this weekend. Really excited about it. Also, Menace to the Midwest will drop on Tuesday to the public, Monday to Patreon. So make sure you check that out. And always a reminder, interested in sponsorship and advertising, reach out, sponsorship@menacetosocietypodcast.com, and make sure you check out the tailgate. I'm telling you right now, you are going to want to be there. And so there's no way to prove that. We've never had one yet. But it's the first one. All I can tell you is we're doing it the right way. It's going to be awesome. The location couldn't be better. All the aspects of it are going to be phenomenal. It's going to be really fun, and there's going to be some special guests. And one other thing I do want to mention, people said, what players are coming? This has nothing to do with former players. Yeah. If they come, great. I mean, I've had a handful I have a relationship with that said they want to stop by, so there's probably going to be some there, but I'm not using a single player to promote it, exactly. Market it. It has nothing to do with them. So don't ask. I'm not going to tell you even if they're guaranteed coming right. Because I'm not trying to make a dollar off of some player. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a great event. Great. It's going to be a really fun time. You're going to be happy and pleased that you came. So check it out and I guess take my word for it. But thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it. Hopefully you were entertained, educated, whatever. And as we say, if you weren't, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on Earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my ass.